This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, who is favourites for the Premier League title after the great game between Manchester City and Liverpool? We'll talk about tactical fouling at the Etihad as well. Elsewhere, Spurs beat Aston Villa by 4-0. But what does that mean for Steven Gerrard's side? We'll talk about Arsenal as well and that race for the top four. Manchester United totally out of it. Why do we still even talk about them and what's going on at the bottom after defeat for Burnley at Norwich? All that and more on The Game. Hello again. Welcome back to The Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wilson-Crowe. I mean, what a weekend it is. I'm not even going to finish my own name. It was so bloody brilliant. Alison Rudd is here. Tom Clark is here. And Paul Hurst joins us for the first part of the podcast where we have to discuss, of course, we have to begin with events at the Etihad. City 2, Liverpool 2. It means Manchester City stay 1 point ahead. Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp hugging at the end. That's why it's not a big rivalry, not to go back too far to last week's podcast, but there you had it in a microcosm. I think people were so distracted by what a great game it was, especially for the neutrals, that actually the context of it, people didn't care. I mean, you went back to the Sky Studio at the end and they're all sort of like, yeah, well, you know, still a point. There was no real gravitas in what it meant for the title race. And I actually think it did have a hugely significant meaning for the title race. But we'll come on to that. Paul, you were there. How great a game was it?
It was an amazing game. You know, I'd have a lie down after it was that that frenetic. And, that early goal from City as well really got the crowd going and made it even more of a spectacle. Sort of took the nerves out of it. I don't think neither team showed any kind of nervousness, which is indicative of how good they are. They are, in my opinion, the best two teams in Europe, and they just both went for it, didn't they? And that was the most pleasing aspect of it. There was no caginess. They didn't stand off each other. They just went for it, and it was a really good exhibition of attacking football, and it goes to show why those two are so far ahead of the rest of the pack.
What do you think it showed us about the two teams, other than how good they are? I mean, versus one another. Is there an element now that Manchester City are growing? They've been pushed a little bit further by Liverpool and are able to hold them at arm's length? Or, if you're a Liverpool fan, did you think this match showed that even when City are playing brilliantly well and you're not playing particularly great, you've still got their number?
I think Liverpool will be the happier of the two teams because of the fact that they played what, 6 out of 10 overall for their performance, even though there were some moments of brilliance. But you know, City were for me the better team, but they just couldn't finish them off. I know we've had this kind of false nine debate regarding City all season, but in some ways, when they do play a false nine, they are a better team. They are more, you know, there's more options, there's more movement, etc. But there's so many times yesterday where a ball was put across the box and you were just, you know, if Haaland was there or Harry Kane was there, it'd be a goal, wouldn't it? So, you know, and City wouldn't have been able to kill Liverpool off in the first half. So I think it also shows that, you know, there is still that minor weakness in the City team that needs addressing in the summer. And you know, if they do address it by bringing Haaland in, then you know, God help the rest of the Premier League, because you know, will make them make them almost invincible, I'd say. So yeah, but I think Liverpool will still be happy that they're actually in the race rather than 4 points behind.
Hurstie, you touched on false nine and tactics there. You know, Hugh and lots of others in the media have been critical of Guardiola sometimes in big games for his tactics. I actually thought that, as you say, had they had a striker on the pitch, it would have been perfect. But I actually thought his tactics were really good, particularly, you know, going to Gabriel Jesus, playing on the right, and seemingly managed to, for large parts, counter Liverpool's fullback threat. What did you think of Pep's tactics?
Yeah, I think that's exactly why he picked Gabriel, because he's a real grafter. You know, he works just as hard as people like Bernardo Silva and Kevin De Bruyne in that team. So I thought that was a good decision. He's also he's suspended for the Atletico Madrid match, so it also made sense from that point of view. I thought it was also a good move to put Bernardo. Bernardo played a little deeper on yesterday.
Yeah.
They sort of played 4-2-3-1, and he was alongside Rodri. And getting him on the ball as early as possible is a great move, because he's just he's a fantastic player, very creative, very industrious, and doesn't mind. I know he's very small and very short, but he can put in a tactical foul, etc., and pull a shirt and stop a counter attack, etc., as well. So, I think he's really good in that position. I don't like to see him on the wing. I think central midfield is his best area. So, yeah, there was no left field tactics, no Gundogan on the right wing or Laporte left back. So, and I think it worked, didn't it? And putting forward and back in the team as well, I thought that was a good move as well. So I think you got it pretty much spot on, Pep.
Before you go, Hirsty, our big argument in about 10 minutes' time is going to be who are the favourites for the Premier League. It was a bit of a missed opportunity, I think, from City, but how do you feel about it? Is 1 point enough for them to be champions? Did that draw in many ways put them then in pole position?
I think it just keeps them ahead, obviously. But I still think that both teams will drop points before the end of the season. Liverpool got some tough fixtures, haven't they? They got United to come, and I know United's terrible at the moment, but they're still capable of pulling off I don't know about that. With zero conviction whatsoever. I'm not thinking about previous Man United, who actually tried to play football, etc. But they got Spurs as well, haven't they? Spurs are a good team. They're better than Man United by a long way, so they'll give them a go. Yeah, and City, they play West Ham away. Before last season, they had a really good record at West Ham, but I don't know, I just quite fancy West Ham to give them a good game. And they've got Villa as well, Leeds away. But I think both teams will drop points, but I think, City will probably just edge it by a point or two.
We will see. And we'll argue about that very shortly. Paul Hirst, thanks for joining us on the Game Podcast.
Cheers, guys. Thanks.
Right then, to your two opinions on it. Alison, we know you're slightly biased on this. What did you make of the game?
Well, I'm still feeling slightly queasy because I ate a lot of chocolate, which is how I cope with big games where a lot's riding on them. Yeah, I bought my niece a chocolate bunny, and it melted slightly, so I thought I'll have to eat it. So I had the whole thing. so it was a strange game because it was captivating, but when you're feeling slightly, oh my goodness, I can't cope with the pressure and the intensity of this, and I'm feeling sick as well. What have I done? Anyway, I'm sure a lot of fans felt like that, actually. That seems to be the mood of the nation, was if you're a neutral, wow, what fun. If you cared about either team, your stomach churned. Weirdly, often I often love Tony Cascarino on a Monday, often don't agree with him, but I agree with Tony Cascarino today. It was a game where you found yourself thinking, oh, why has he done that? Why have they done that? Oh, that's interesting. And it was like offering the world a template into their insight. We often think that the two managers involved are just such elite coaches. Can us mere mortals understand what's going on? And you felt they were sort of letting us peek behind the curtain a little bit. And I did think, has he chosen Jesus because he's got a good record at home against Liverpool? Seems a bizarre sort of random sort of superstitious thing to do, but it was all about exploiting Liverpool's high line, and it was fascinating that Liverpool didn't adapt, knowing that's what was going on. And they stuck to their guns, maintained the high line, and City kept on exploiting it. It was fascinating. And Cascarino, he agreed with me. The two standout individuals were Kevin De Bruyne and Matip. Liverpool, I think, would have lost this game, but for Matip's performance in the first half, when Liverpool were jittery, making more mistakes than normal, but maybe that's not so unusual when you're playing against the team that are favourites to win the title. And I just thought he was absolutely immense, so calm, there's something about a good central defender, isn't there, and everyone else is going slightly berserk. They control the game and make the right decisions, crucially. Loved his performance, Kevin De Bruyne. very, you know, the way he steps up when it matters is absolutely incredible. So I don't think anyone would argue that a draw, although I kind of feel if, you know, if they're going to keep drawing 2-2, can't they just sort of put that into the system and we don't have to go through the mill? Because, because like I said, I was feeling a bit queasy through it. But it was fascinating.
I think I'm going to be the person that would have disagreed with that statement had you got to the end of it. You said, I don't think anyone would disagree before you diverged. And I think you were going to say that a draw was a fair result.
Yeah, it doesn't need saying, does it?
City deserved to win. Absolutely, City deserved to win.
No, they were at home.
Absolutely,
they were at home.
City deserved to win.
They were at home, and Liverpool did enough to make
them
wobble.
They had two chances. They scored twice. Liverpool were fantastic in front of goal, and had they had the number of chances that Man City had, they would have scored 7 goals because they would have been clinical. City weren't clinical, but they definitely deserved to win the game. In fact, they should be delighted, because I actually think that was one of their best performances against Liverpool. Liverpool found it so hard to play for so many long periods of the game, and the only time that they really had the ball was when City had a little bit of a breather and went, oh, we can't just keep bopping it around here, and we can't just keep sprinting in behind, we can't just keep exposing Trent Alexander-Arnold, we can't just, you know, they got into the box, they had over twice as many touches inside the opposition penalty area. They missed, as Hirsty pointed out, a top draw striker in it, and look, Pep can argue all he wants that they don't need one. They definitely deserve to win that game. And this is my overarching feeling listening to the reaction, was that because it was such a great game and because it left us in exactly the same state as when we went into it, people weren't taking much from the game other mm-hmm. than what a treat that was. And I was like, whoa, I've just watched Man City miss a huge opportunity to go 4 points clear because they dominated the game. For me, in terms of maybe not clear-cut chances, but that one extra pass that they needed to have the clear-cut chance is where they let themselves down. They had Mahrez's chance at the end of the game. Rodri should have nodded across for John Stones to have a tap-in. Like, they, in the first half, they could have scored 3 or 4 easily and been out of sight at that point. It was a great game. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I don't think a draw was a fair result.
Allow me to be a mediator for once. For once, that'd be a nice role for me to take on. Hugh, you make an interesting point about the draw and the general perception, because insight into kind of newspaper workings, when you work on a Sunday and there's loads of action going on and we're producing the game and loads of all of our football coverage, we editors are kind of sat there and going, the last thing you want is a draw. You want a kind of win-loss definitive storyline. And this was one of the few times where we're kind of discussing what's going to be the front cover of the game supplement, what we're going to put top of the website. And we're like, draw's great, because it's still on. We keep going. The drama keeps going. So you're absolutely right in that sense. It was a strange occasion like that. I would just quibble with your choice of the word deserve. City should have won, but that doesn't mean they deserve to win.
Yeah, I think, because finishing chances is part of the game.
Exactly. But also,
that's a negative,
staying in the game is part of the game and part of the battle. And Liverpool did that very well. I think when you consider the goals that they scored, to score the goal, those two goals at those moments is incredibly impressive, because few other teams would be able to kind of rise to produce those goals, which were very Liverpool goals, particularly the first, and they both kind of came slightly out of nowhere. And you kind of pan to Pep Guardiola on the touchline, he's going, for God's sake, we've fallen for it, we've just switched off for that 1 second and they've got us. But Liverpool still have to produce that moment of quick passing, pressing, magic and counter-attacking to score those goals. So I would just quibble with your choice of the word deserve. City should have won the game, but I think a draw can be considered fair, because it was that kind of back and forth, and Liverpool deserve credit for that by not being overawed by being the, you know, the less good team.
Nah, if you're going to go through sliding doors moments, I mean, Edison could very easily have scored an own goal.
He was totally relaxed.
He knew what he was doing. Don't be slagging off my mate Edison. Come on. He knew what he was doing. One interesting thing I wanted to ask both of you about is, and Tony Cascarino has written about this morning, both in the paper and online, was Liverpool's kind of slightly more cynical tactics, should we say. And now we've all heard Jurgen Klopp in the past complaining cheekily about opposition teams kicking his players and stopping them, and it wasn't very fair and we didn't get any help from the ref. Well, he definitely got some help from the ref yesterday, didn't he? I mean, that was the most, you know, I said this on Twitter, that was the most cynical I've ever seen a Jurgen Klopp Liverpool team. And I don't mind it, because it's fair play, do what you need to do. But I did think it was quite telling that, you know, they resorted to that. And there was those moments when Van Dijk cleaned De Bruyne out on a counter-attack. But it was interesting De Bruyne's reaction. It wasn't what the reaction would have been had it been a Newcastle defender or a Burnley defender, i.e. jump up furious. Ref, book him. Right. You know, he kind of just high-fived Van Dijk and said, well played, mate. Fair enough. I would have done the same to you. I thought that was really interesting.
Do you want to
I'm actually surprised more teams don't do it against City, because all Pep teams have been tactical fouling teams.
Absolutely.
This is the point. More teams can't get away with it against City because of the perception of the two sides. The perception, if you are, I don't know, if you're Norwich and you go out there and you keep fouling Manchester City, is that you're trying to stop them. You're destroying the game. You're destroying the spectacle. You're stopping this brilliant team from scoring amazing goals because you just keep kicking them. And that's the only way you're going to get a result. Whereas when you're a great team like Liverpool, the perception is not the only way that we can get a result here today is by fouling them. It's totally different. You know, you've got Pep Guardiola on the side saying, look, if you stop them from fouling us, we're going to win. You're deciding the result by letting them get away with it. You can't say that against Liverpool. You can't say, we'd be winning 5-0 if they weren't fouling us. You can't say that because you probably wouldn't be. And so they get away with it in a game like that, and it's just not going to be a deciding factor. I also think the referees aren't as keen to allow their officiating to decide a match of that magnitude. I think it's a bit like the end of the F1, you know, it's a bit last season.
Keep
in that.
The drama.
Yeah, exactly. Keep the drama. Let people enjoy it. Mm. Don't let them walk off like they did at the end of the F1, complaining about the officials.
But you're right as well, and this is a point Tony makes as well, that this is not exclusive to Liverpool. And as you say, Pep's teams have always done it. Sir Alex Ferguson's Manchester United team were not afraid to kick the crap out of another opposition team, as they did very successfully with Arsenal. Arsenal's invincibles. Mm. And also Wenger's early teams. I was looking at some stats earlier and discussing it with James in the office. And 2001-2002 season, when they won the title, having lost to Man United for a couple of seasons, they had 11 red cards in all competitions. And, you know, he was saying, having spoken to Martin Keown, that Keown just said, we just went into tackles a bit harder because we were like, we are not going to lose this. Mourinho's teams, it always happens. I just think this raised an interesting point, and Tony discussed it with me, that, as you say, Hugh, should we now not allow the Burnleys, the Newcastles, the Norwiches a bit of a let-off, because we see them all the big dogs do it, and when they have to, it's about winning.
Football's about perception. I say it all the time. Football is about perception, how we react to it, how people react to the game on the sidelines and on the pitch as well, in many regards. You know, certain players get a bad rap, a bad reputation, and they are treated differently by officials once they do. Soon, by the way, Anthony Gordon will have a reputation as a diver, and he's not going to be getting any of these decisions because he's thrown himself all over the place. But then who had that before? Dele Alli. Yeah. And, you know, he used to get loads of decisions, then he stopped because he got the public persona of someone that goes down easily. Yeah. And then now it's Raheem Sterling, and it was Ashley Young, and perception is huge. Yeah. And like I say, the perception of teams lower down the table is that the only way they can stop Man City is by fouling them or doing something like that.
But it's posh fouling, isn't it?
There was nothing posh about the Fabinho foul. That wasn't posh.
No, that wasn't absolutely. But I'm talking in general terms about tactical fouling being a part of your approach to a match. If you're someone like City, that they do it very cleverly, so they remain the right side of the law.
I don't think they do it any clever. Fernandinho, let's talk about him.
I'm not talking about this match. I'm talking about generally
over the course of the last 5 years, a bit longer, Fernandinho has been pretty key to their tactical fouling, and people watch game after game after game and say, how on earth is Fernandinho getting away with it? If Fernandinho was Lee's Milu for Norwich, he wouldn't get away with it. If he just kept tripping people up as they ran through central midfield towards the penalty box, he wouldn't get away with it because he would be perceived to be stopping better sides from scoring loads of goals. Fernandinho got away with it because no one thought Man City were going to lose the game. It wasn't going to affect things if he didn't get a yellow card after yellow card after yellow card. But he, you know, and then what did Pep do? And this is another reason why they want 5 subs. It's just like, get a few yellows and then we'll take you all off and we'll bring someone else on and they'll get a yellow and we'll be fine. We'll keep tactical fouling our way through the season. Obviously, that's not how they win titles, but it does help them.
Yeah, but it's done cleverly. It's not just about perception. It is about The level of tackle, when they do it, where they do it on the pitch. Yeah.
But those players create that perception that you're talking about, Hugh. Fernandinho created that by his mannerisms on the pitch, by his relationship with the referee. You know, all these things do influence a referee. And the decision, I mean, Alisson, you're a referee and a Liverpool fan. Fabinho? Come on, that's a red card, right?
No.
Absolutely.
It wasn't dangerous.
Okay. It's Thiago, second yellow.
I'm surprised he didn't get a second yet.
I couldn't believe
Very
it.
Very diplomatic.
I couldn't believe the first one.
She says with a wry grin.
Unbelievable. But it made for a great game. And if you're neutral, you are very happy about how the game went, because I thought it was one of those, you know, old cliche, great advert for English football in the Premier League, etc., etc. But it was. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant game. They'll play again at the weekend in the FA Cup as well. Hopefully that's another treat. I'm sure Pep Guardiola plays everyone that didn't play this weekend anyway. And that maybe affects things. In terms of the Premier League, though, they do stay a point ahead. We need to discuss, I think, who are the favourites now, because it was meant to be a title decider. Didn't go one way or the other. The gap stays at one point, as I mentioned. In terms of the remaining games, for me, the big ones for Manchester City are trips to Wolves, West Ham and Leeds, actually, I think are their trickiest ties. Liverpool do host Wolves and Spurs, which I think makes a difference because those are their tougher games. Everton and Manchester United, obviously, big fixtures for Liverpool. I don't see those two teams getting anywhere near this Liverpool side. So Wolves and Spurs. Wolves, if they have a great day, they can defend pretty well. Spurs are obviously in very good form. Who do you see winning the title now?
Liverpool. I said Liverpool a while ago. And also, without wanting to be that guy, I've said for a while that I didn't think Manchester City, in those games that you've highlighted, Hugh, they were excellent. That's the best I've seen them against all season against Liverpool. But in those games, when I've watched them, Hugh, those ones you've just picked out, Leeds, Wolves, West Ham, I don't think they have been as good. Mm. And I think the kind of striker, central attacking position is a problem in those games, as it was against Crystal Palace. So I actually think they'll drop points in those games. You know, as Hirsty said, I think both teams will continue to drop points. But I think you're right to pick out the... It's the on paper versus reality thing. And on paper, everyone looks at it and goes, oh my God, Liverpool have got Tottenham and they've got Manchester United and they'll be well up for it and all that kind of stuff. But I just think in reality, those City games are trickier in reality. And that is what it'll come down to. And I think Liverpool will just sneak it.
I agree.
Well, there's just no point in clawing back the 14-point gap unless you're going to win the title.
Says and spoken like a true novelist.
Exactly. Should we use the N-word? No, we won't use the narrative word. But it feels like... Also, there is the psychology of Liverpool are still hunting down City. And I do feel that means there's more pressure on City whether they like it or not.
I think it suits the two, actually, weirdly, I think... Not that Liverpool would have minded if they'd won, but do you know what I mean? In a strange way, that kind of battling performance, being seen as the less good team on the day, but still be in it, and then go into those games against Everton, Manchester United, Tottenham, and be under, you know, the pressure's on City, I think. And Pep alluded to that in his quotes, didn't he? So, and I just think that suits Liverpool more than it suits City. When they've both also got other competitions that they're going for.
City have, for me, pretty much two elite players in every position except for centre forward. And I actually think the game of the weekend underlined their major fragility, which is they leave points and results out there. Hmm. You know, you guys know it's pretty much one of my bugbears with Manchester City. They do. I watch so many of their games and people go, oh, they got a point and they carried on, or they should win all of these games. Mm. They should, as you mentioned earlier, have won that game. Mm. Had they bought a serious centre forward, if they had one in their side, they would have won that game. And that's their fragility. You know, they're going to play Atletico this week, and you think the way that they dominated the first leg, well, they're not going to get knocked out against Atletico. And you sit there and you go, well, if they put 11 players behind the ball, they don't have that figurehead. They don't have someone that's going to create a goal from nothing. It was a moment of magic. Moments of magic score them goals a lot of the time. Instead of that regulation pattern of play that they used to have when there was a forward in the box, you know, if you put it across the City, all those balls that Matip cut out. No, seriously, though.
You're starting to sound like a Man City fan, not a United fan, Hugh.
Manchester City got into those positions, and I kept saying, why haven't they flashed the ball across the face of the goal? As you'd expect, on the byline, whip it in there? Why are they cutting them back to the... And that's because no one had made the run.
No one's in there.
No one's made a run into the six-yard box. And you're like, had someone done that, there's a tap in there. But no one gets close enough to get those tap-ins because there's no one thinking like a centre forward. And as great as they are with false nines... there's a reason everyone has a striker. I mean, there is a reason for that. I keep trying to put myself in Pep Guardiola's shoes. Like, there must be a reason why they play not one, but occasionally two false nines. And De Bruyne and Foden, aren't they great when they score these goals? And look, he's reinvented football. And then games like this, you go, oh, that's why everyone buys a striker for 100 million quid and everyone wants a goal scorer, because those are the games that they win you. And
so you've changed. So what you're coming to is to say that now you've changed your mind and you agree with me and Alison.
Yeah, I do. I do. I have changed my mind. I absolutely have changed my mind, because the game against Spurs, I think I said it, you don't dominate a team as good as City with the best squad I think I've ever seen in football, the most technically gifted squad, as Edison showed us at the weekend, in footballing history, should not lose matches ever that they dominate. In my opinion, against anyone. If City dominate a game, even against Liverpool, I think they should win it. I honestly think they should win it. And that's the difference for me. And I think there is that, you can call it a fragility, a weakness, whatever you want, but when it's tough for them, that's why they don't go home with 3 points. And that's the only reason. More for us to discuss, and we'll in fact mention Manchester United a little bit later on. We're going to stay towards the top of the table, though. The race for the top four is, I'd love to say, hotting up. It's not. It is if you're a Spurs fan, but it's not generally speaking, because they're the only team in the race, if you like, that won this weekend. They went to Aston Villa. 4 goals were scored, a hat-trick for Heung-Min Son. It means Spurs are fourth after 4 straight wins, 4 straight defeats for Villa as well, who afterwards, the Villa boss Steven Gerrard said, were magnificent in the first half. And I think they were. They had so many chances they just couldn't take and were punished by that Harry Kane-Son combo once again. And Alison, you were there, so tell us, what were your reflections?
Oh, it was absolutely a remarkable match. Really strange. I don't think I've been to one like it, actually. And at the end, managers sit down, and often the first question's, the obvious question, and it's usually, so, manager X, how do you sum that up? So Gerrard was asked, how do you sum that up? And he just sat there and stared at everyone. And there was this long, pregnant pause. And I did think, is he actually going to say anything? He's so stunned. And he didn't know how to analyse it, how to sum it up. Because for 40 minutes, Villa played like the best team in the world. Seriously. I mean, Coutinho was prompting them, every single Villa player, to play like they've never played before. There were back heels, dribbles, quick thinking, clever free kick routines. They were bubbling away and forcing Lloris to make great saves, and there were blocks and there were poor misses and poor finishing, but the build-up play and the imagination was phenomenal. But there's this really weird thing happening at Aston Villa, which is they've only got one half of football in them. And they when you're up against a front line like Spurs currently have, that's not enough. You can't play one half of football. And so they didn't get the goal they should have got, the goals they should have got from some amazing play, and they just ran out of puff yet again. Often with Villa, it's the other way around. They start badly and Gerrard gives them a rollicking at half time, and they come out and do something better in the second half. They might not win, but they improve. For some reason, this is a big problem they've got. They have 45 minutes in them, and that's it.
I was going to say, that was what we praised Gerrard for, wasn't he, when he came in, those kind of turnarounds at Villa Park where they got points from losing positions. Is it the player's quality that maybe he's now had time to implement his full, more fully fledged style, if you like, and it's rather than it being Steven Gerrard giving a rollicking team talk, this is actually a fully formed plan that they can't fulfil, or is it something more in the ether?
Well, I don't. Well, worryingly for Villa, I'm not sure Steven Gerrard knows what it is. I could be very mean and say he's come from a division in Scotland where it's just not as demanding and he's not prepared the players properly for the rigours of what you get over 90 minutes in the Premier League, because that's what it looks like. It is quite strange. You know, they're not all over 30. They're, I mean, there's a nice mixture of age and experience in that team. It's just... I mean, I think after previous matches, Gerrard has said, for some reason, his team seems to have to work harder to get the rewards than anyone else seems to get. So if they score, you feel like, well, that took a lot out of them. Whereas some, like Spurs did, score quite effortlessly. And that's peculiar. Maybe because he's a new manager, come in without a pre-season, they're having to overthink it. There's too much going on in their heads and they're having to... They're not a natural team yet. But they're just not pacing themselves. I've not seen anything quite like it, actually. I mean, they're not in danger of going down, fortunately, but it is strange that even the teams at the bottom of the table, they're pacing themselves properly. It is a conundrum, and it probably speaks to Gerrard's lack of experience as a manager in this division.
Yeah, I mean, on Villa, there's part of me that thinks he believes if you really have that spell where you score a couple of goals, you can manage the game. I don't think there's a plan for managing the game if you don't get those goals. But they're not good defensively. They're not good enough defensively. And they waste a lot of chances. And there's a part of me that says, if he just makes it their brand to be a really intense football team, a bit like Ralph Hasenhüttl has tried to do with Southampton, of course Marcelo Bielsa did at Leeds, that actually they would be a better team. If they just said, well, we're going to be a sprawling team that gets all over you, tries to have that intense way of scoring a few goals, you know, just get the ball into the box, get shots off. Because that's how they play in those periods where they're being really good at aggressively attacking team. And that's where they score their goals. I still think they don't have natural goal scorers apart from Ings, who's not played that much or that well. But actually, it doesn't go far back in the team. It sort of stops in the midfield. And then the defenders are all playing a different style of football, which is like we just sit back behind the ball and we're really safe and we don't affect the game aggressively. I don't think the defence is aggressive enough. And I actually think there would just be a better side if they had that identity all the way through the team. It's very much like the forward third is one identity and the defence is another style of football. And when the ball goes into their defensive third, they're a different Aston Villa defending than they are attacking. He needs to get that throughout all of their play, I think. I think that's the best Villa, that one that we saw where they were having all those chances.
Yeah.
But then you are going to run the players into the ground. That's fine. That happens at other clubs. You rotate. You plan for a squad that is going to have to be that intense in every single match, and you rotate the team throughout the season. I actually think they could play like that. They probably should play like that. The one where they all get behind the ball, they're not good enough.
No.
They're not good enough.
But there's Alisson's talking about stamina and you're talking about, you know, fitness and pressing and being high intensity. That takes time, doesn't it?
Mm.
It took Marcelo Bielsa time at Leeds, for example. You could argue Ralph Hasenhüttl still trying to implement that style effectively, given Southampton's results of late. But I also wonder, with the kind of Gerrard appointment, and we talked about it at the time, we all said, I think, you know, Dean Smith, will they be in any different position? Doesn't look like they probably will, I don't think. This summer will be very interesting, won't it, in terms of they've already spent quite a lot of money. I wonder whether Gerrard will be expecting, even demanding, that they spend quite a lot of money again. By all accounts, they're able to. They've got the financial backing and support to do so. But you guys are talking about implementing a playing style that requires probably more hours on the training ground and also more technically proficient players. So I wouldn't be surprised to see quite a lot of money spent at Villa Park if the idea of the Gerrard project is to take them up to that kind of West Ham, Leicester level of pushing for the European places.
I think they can do it. I think they can do it next season or the season after. Steven Gerrard, jury's still out. But a young manager, as Alisson pointed out, who's finding his way a little bit. On Tottenham Hotspur, though, more goals. They're turning into one of the strongest teams in the Premier League over the past few weeks. It's been a remarkable few weeks for them. They were eighth and they are now fourth. I know Arsenal have a game in hand, 3 points behind them. But for many people, if they keep this up, I mean, they're a shoo-in to be in the Champions League spots. I think Antonio Conte is turning them into contenders.
Well, it looks that way, doesn't it? They are... I sort of said yes. I think I said yes in my piece. I don't know if I did. I don't know if I dared to, really. They seem to have grit. I never thought I'd say that sentence. Spurs seem to have grit. They rode the storm. They took their chances. They played with freedom. They were clinical when they needed to be. Didn't mind being overrun when they were overrun. Had faith in their goalkeeper. It was a proper grown-up, let's build on our momentum type of performance, which I think is summed up when you watch Conte in action. So there's something weird going on. He honestly does celebrate each goal more deliriously than any manager in the universe, right? He just does. He just does. And the fan, that means the fans, even though he's new to the club and he was a Chelsea manager, they sing his name more than any other club sing the manager's name in the universe. So that's strange. He looks like he's completely decided, I now love Spurs. I can make this work. His whole demeanour is one of having had all that flaky flip-flopping. I don't know if I want to say. He looks like he's committed now. Everyone's very relieved. Everyone's bought into the methodology he has, which is very tough on the players. He's exuberant and amazing. And then he looked like he'd lost 4-0 afterwards. Didn't look happy. Said it's very important. You know, the other results went his way. Of course they did. But, you know, there's so much more he wants from the team. And this is proper grown-up management of a team that has floated around promising much and never delivering. So people say, don't they, the best marriages are the ones where you come through difficulty at the start and then you're solid and then you grow. It seems to be this way with Spurs. It was a difficult start for them and Conte, and it's that come through the hard part. And if he does get them Champions League football, you'd have to say maybe next season is promising for them.
And they would have to have a big summer as well, actually.
They would, yeah.
But Rodrigo Bentancur, Dejan Kulusevski, I mean, he's got in those two, of course. Christian Romero came in from Serie A before, but I think if he wants to go to the board and buy more players from Serie A, I think the three signings that have come in from Italy are doing very, very well, have changed the team. And I think he can have that argument now. You know, the one that was threatening to walk away? Well, he can now go up to the board and say, let's do some more of this and we're going to get better.
The only problem with that argument, though, is if he gets Champions League with what he's got already, they'll go, well, that's fine. We just want some nice Champions League nights in our big, beautiful stadium. That's fine, Antonio. We don't want any more than that. Obviously they won't.
You're spot on.
They want the world, but the reality is that they're...
I don't think the club hierarchy does.
No.
I think Antonio Conte does.
Yeah, he does, but they're miles off City and Liverpool, as we've discussed before, and as Chelsea prove. So that's the difficulty, isn't it? I think you're right, Alison, that they've come through that, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's another little wobble to come at some point.
Well, they are Spurs.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, for their North London rivals, who are also going for a place in the Champions League, as I mentioned, Arsenal, back-to-back defeats. A loss to Brighton at the Emirates, 2-1. Huge credit to Brighton. We're not going to talk about them in detail, but they got their first win in 8 games. As James Gearbrunt points out, though, in today's Times, Mikel Arteta needs to take some responsibility for how that result came about, because without left-back Kieran Tierney, he preferred moving Granit Xhaka out of of midfield to cover instead of playing the, albeit struggling at the moment, Nuno Tavares. And with Thomas Partey already missing from central midfield, well, then the whole system needed a tweak. And in the end, it didn't really work. How big a mistake was it from Arteta to do that?
Oh, Mikel, why are you doing this to me? I can still remember, Hugh. It was Christmas. I was sat at home with my family. Our family dog, Ralph, was sat in front of the fire. It was cold outside and we were recording a podcast and you said to me, who's the manager of the season? And I said, Mikel Arteta. And you all laughed. And I've thought about it since and I thought, yes, I can't wait for producer John to clip that up at the end of the season. I'm going to look like a genius. And he's determined to scupper me. Mikel, what are you doing? Why are you doing this to me? Yeah, James's analysis, as always, is very interesting and really, really on point. That position in midfield was where Brighton, you know, they got their goals as well. The kind of pullback to Trossard coming in on the edge of the box, which was a lovely finish, goal. Yeah. Lovely finish. One of those kind of really talented players, I always think, whenever I watch Trossard.
With all due respect to Brighton, every time I watch him, I'm like, he reeks of Champions League squad player. Just, like, he's
exactly,
good enough.
Yeah.
He is.
A Diego Jota, maybe.
Exactly. Probably be at Man United next year.
He is captain of the undead team, though.
Is he?
Yeah. What's players that? Who look undead.
Too many bags under his eyes.
No, he has that look where he doesn't look quite alive.
Needs a bit blusher on. Is that what you're saying? Well, there may be lots to discuss maybe next time on players who need a bit of makeup. But yes, coming back to the point about Arsenal, it does feel like as a team and as a manager, they're getting a bit twitchy and a bit fidgety and overthinking it. You know, we've talked about Pep Guardiola. Mm. Perhaps he's got a bit of that in him as well, Arteta. As you say, forced upon him by the likes of Tierney being out and Thomas Partey as well, who has become increasingly influential. But this is where all the things that we talked about and praise them for, the young team, the pressing, the enthusiasm, the exuberance, just doesn't... Yeah, this is where you fall down. And it's going to be really hard for them now because that's the other thing that happens with young youthful teams managed by young managers is that they don't have that grit that Alisson is talking about Tottenham having now. And so when it comes to a run in and they've both got to play each other, Arsenal fans are going to start getting jittery and worried again. And look, I'm still going to back them for fourth because I have done all season and I desperately want that acclaim of calling Mikel Arteta really early. But if I were an Arsenal fan, as I am being temporarily in this sense, I would start being a bit worried by these kind of performances as much as the results.
But I think this is fascinating because what counts more for a team is it that you maintain your shape? And Arsenal are famously 4-2-3-1. It's what they are. They were that before Arteta when they were playing well. You knew you were going to get two holding midfielders with Arsenal. Yeah, the world's spinning on its axis. Mm-hmm. That's what happens. That's what you do. And so if you've got injuries, surely you think, well, okay, we haven't got the first choice personnel throughout the team, but if we maintain the shape we're all used to, we can get through it. And yet Arteta is either over tinkering or is nervous or feels it's his job to do more than just say, well, I'll just move pieces around as long as the shape's okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I was on Tube on my way to Villa and sat on the same tube that fans were going to watch Arsenal, and they were reading out the team sheet and the fans were going, oh yeah, he doesn't like Tavares, does he?
Mm.
And that's not healthy when everyone knows a manager just doesn't like a particular player who has a role to play when there's injuries. That's the point of him, isn't it? You don't buy players and stick them around the club saying, oh, you're the one that's not liked. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think you and I had a heated debate, shall we say, earlier in the season, Alisson, about Arsenal kind of plan A and a lack of a plan B at times and Arteta not being able to change it mid-game. I think this is perhaps another example of that where he's just not confident enough in his squad. He's now confident in his kind of plan A and his starting 11. But when he doesn't have that, he really struggles because he says things like, I don't like Tavares, so I'm not going to play him. And that is his failing as a manager. But it's, again, we've talked about Villa, we've talked about Tottenham. This is, again, another example of where Arsenal will need a big summer in some senses because that's how they can kick on, because they should be able to be without Kieran Tierney and Thomas Partey and still perform to the level to get a result against Brighton at home.
Good managers make everyone in the squad feel important.
Yeah.
They really do. And Arteta's getting a reputation for falling out with players now. I look at Aubameyang. He's just ripping it up at Barcelona.
He is. Absolutely. But I still think that was... I remember Tom Ruddy saying it on the podcast that he thought it'll be a classic case of where it could be a good move for Arsenal, Aubameyang and Barcelona, and that all those things can be true. I think you're right to raise it as a point of where he fell out with someone.
I'm not saying it wasn't right for the club, but I'm just saying it looks like Arteta does fall out with too many people. The best managers, part of what makes them great, great managers, and this is to answer your point about could he be manager of the season, is who you have in reserve and how you make them feel when they're given their, you know, occasional minute here, 10 minutes there, or a whole match because there's an injury crisis. If they come in feeling great about it, that's fantastic man management.
I've been criticised for highlighting his lack of man management skills with the players that he's fallen out with. He hasn't actually positively resolved any of those situations other than selling the players. And eventually, he's going to want to keep one of these players or need to keep one of these players. You know, Bukayo Saka, his contract's coming up. What if, you know, he stalls on it? What's he going to do then? Is he going to argue with one of the club's best players, one of the best up-and-coming youngsters in the world? No, he isn't. He has to start resolving some of these issues, and there must be these issues at every single football club. Anyway, by the by, they need to win games. Southampton away next, very tricky. Chelsea away, Man United at home, West Ham away, Leeds at home, Tottenham away. I mean, that's the season, basically, and it's tough.
It looks very tough, and I'm starting to wonder that they're going to get blown away by Tottenham when it comes to that game. But Hugh, I wanted to ask you, as a Manchester United fan, and we'll come to their perils in a moment, but, you know, Arsenal and Tottenham, and we talk about this top four race, we thought those three teams were all considered to be in it. As a Manchester United fan looking on at the outside, would you rather have the Tottenham situation of world-class manager proven at the highest level with some world-class players, Harry Kane, Son, and, you know, looking like a better transfer strategy, or young manager, lots of promise, lots of young players, and starting to get it together with an attractive style of football? Which would you rather have?
You'd rather have Conte all day long. Yeah, of course. I'd rather have Conte with Norwich's squad. No, to be perfectly honest, yeah, I mean, you've got a winning manager who knows how to win trophies, knows how to win big games. I know Arteta's won an FA Cup already, but... No, I think you'd rather be in the Tottenham position, which is the chance to build on some very good players and an excellent manager than... To be fair, everyone at Arsenal has something to prove, and obviously that can work in your favour, but obviously they haven't done anything. I would rather be Spurs fan right now, yeah. And I think they're going to be in the Champions League. Basically, all of my predictions from the start of the season have changed this weekend. So now Tottenham are going to be in the Champions League. Arsenal, forget you. And of course, Liverpool are going to win the league. So Manchester City, you're off as well. Now, I think we need to talk about the team you just mentioned there, my beloved Manchester United, a couple of the other teams who supposedly want to be in the Champions League next season. I'm not too sure that's the case. Everton, huge win for them, beating Manchester United 1-0 at home. Anthony Gordon's deflected winner, enough to move Everton 4 points clear of the relegation zone. Any win is massive for them at the moment. But as I said, United supposedly trying to finish in the top four. For a team that high up the table, it's a huge win for them. We're going to reflect on Manchester United, I think, first. Because we were talking about this a little bit earlier on, Tom. For me, it's the lowest point since Alex Ferguson was appointed at the club. So a long, long time. Because we can now all officially come around to the idea that that dynasty, that time, is dead. I mean, it's dead. It's not just lurking somewhere in the back room that we're going to bring out on a birthday party. It's going to dance in the living room. We're all going to, you know, smile about it. It's gone, okay? It's gone. It's not coming back. They are not a top football team. They might be sometime in the future, but they are in a group of half a dozen teams who might be a great team in a decade. And that's it. They are a former great team.
Yeah.
We can all accept it now.
Yeah. I'm glad you've come round to my opinion, Hugh. I've been saying it all season, for about three seasons, actually. But you make an interesting point about it now being for Manchester United fans, because the other thing we were talking about at the start of the show is, why do we still keep talking about Manchester United? A lot of listeners will be sat there going, yeah, they've been crap for ages. Like, why are you still talking about them? They're rubbish. Like, so annoying. Talk about someone else. But that's the strange thing about, you know, being football journalists, being football fans, is there are a lot of Manchester United fans. One of my good friends is an Arsenal fan from the kind of 90s era and just loves how crap Man United are. Absolutely loves it. So likes, the enjoys, revels in it. So that's part of it as well. But it is interesting because, and Alison, I'm sure, will agree, whether you're a reporter, an editor, a broadcaster, anything, you're like, what the hell do we talk about Manchester United now? What else is there to say? They've been rubbish for a while. They've tried loads of different managers. We know the hierarchy's rubbish. We know the stadium's falling down. They're in a bad way. But it's kind of like, oh, so they've lost to Everton 1-0. I mean, Everton weren't even that good. They just showed a bit more fight and hunger.
Mm. Alison can explain it journalistically perfectly because she's a Liverpool fan. No, seriously. So she's a Liverpool fan who is a journalist, and she would have said and seen all of those years when you still had to talk about Liverpool, but they weren't winning anything. They weren't winning the major titles regularly. Because you still have to talk about clubs with this many fans of this magnitude, despite the fact that there isn't much that interesting. I mean, they're still on, you know, they're still on Super Sunday, Manchester United. They'll probably still get those big TV games, and everyone will sit there and say, I'd rather watch Spurs, or, you know, or I'd rather watch West Ham, you know, if they keep their great success up, or Leicester City, or whoever it might be, over the next 5 years. Because Manchester United are just... they're now, in my opinion, as a radio show host, they're a final hour team as opposed to a first hour team.
And finally, we come to Manchester United.
Exactly.
Who, ladies and gentlemen, are still crap.
Yeah,
a very, very deep well of Schadenfreude, isn't it? That's what's going on here. The peak held by Manchester United. I mean, they were everything that every club aspired to be. They had a really excellent but feared manager. They won not through luck, and they didn't seem to win through money. It seemed to be through having great youth team. Everything was right about the club, and they grew and they grew and they grew, and you'd see Manchester United shirts all around the globe, and it looked like it would go on forever. And the fact that its decline is so visible, so tangible, there's nowhere to hide. And as Tom said, you know, even the ground is crumbling. Everything about it feels like, you know, the Roman Empire. It's gone. But the Roman Empire, we still talk about because they gave us our roads and our irrigation systems and so on. So they still have influence. But it's utterly bizarre. And what I found completely strange and almost unanalyzable is that I thought Man United played quite well for some of the first half. They looked like they were playing with a bit of freedom. And then the fact that they were unable to handle going behind, unable to summon the sort of team talk that Sean Dyche did for Burnley and say, come on, it's Everton. They are so fragile. Look at their results. Don't let the crowd bother you. I mean, come on. The crowd are only like this because they think they're going down. You're Manchester United. They don't have that collective ability to feel that they can bully anyone. I think their manager is so ridiculously laid back. He acts like someone who won the job in a lottery and knows he's got salary paid for the next 5 years and doesn't seem to mind very much. So I don't get a sense of pride from him at all. He just wears his jumpers and shrugs and looks like it's nothing to do with me. I find that the whole thing has gone down so many levels of grandeur. It's utterly, almost inexplicable that they've got to this. And now you've got a case where they're considering who might be the next manager, and they look like they might, you know, flip-flop themselves because they don't want to go there. So... bizarre. But what is also strange is if you look at the markings of the players that were given in the game on Monday, I always look at the markings. You can't, I don't think you can. Can you? Okay, please discuss with me. Can you give Pickford, who had, I thought, one of the best games I've seen for a while, Pickford gets an 8, a deserved 8. I might have given him a 9, actually. But none of the Manchester United team get above a 6, and the forward line get 4s and 5s. That's not right, is it? How can the goalkeeper get an 8 and the forward line of the opposition get very, very low marks? They were clearly doing something to make Pickford man of the match.
Schadenfreude and maths from Alison Rudd all in a small segment there. That's a lot for listeners to take in. But you're right. And I think there were little glimpses, for example, of Marcus Rashford. He's still a long way off the player who first burst onto the scene, but there were little moments where you thought he's got a bit of sharpness and a bit of enthusiasm back. But it's a strange one because, as I say, I do find myself running. I've run out of things to say.
They're done. They're totally done, this squad. they're shell-shocked, they've got PTSD, they need to get out of there and seek help immediately. No, genuinely, yeah. Because they cannot cope with the criticism, the pressure that has come with being in a terrible Manchester United team, the scrutiny, any of it. Look at Cristiano Ronaldo slapping a phone out of a kid's hand. Mm. That's not on brand, no. Is it? I mean, that's it's not really like him, it seems. None of them can cope with it.
Yeah,
they aren't... They've. I mean, they're going to have identity crises. A lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, people who have been talked about as being great potential players in the future, if not the now, destined for greatness, trophies, the international caps, all of that, and everyone is saying you're rubbish. Mm. Fans are saying you're terrible, and even the pundits are saying, oh, they're not terrible, but they're just not good enough for Manchester United.
Yeah.
And you're either stuck in a situation where that will continue because no one else is going to buy you, or you're about to lose all of that and be sold and go to a club that is not as definitely not better than Manchester United. And I don't know anyone that's going to move to a better team sideways at best,
yeah,
for some of those players. So what do you have at the end of it?
But maybe this is the moment, Hugh. Maybe you mark the end, because Alison referenced good marriages earlier, but when it comes to relationships that end, you only truly move on when you leave that behind. And if you're saying that finally we're no longer that dynasty, but that's what it is, because that's why I mentioned the kind of the media debate around them and how many times they're on TV and how many fans talk about them, which briefly to your point about Liverpool, the difference with now compared to the Liverpool team in the 80s and 90s and that kind of decline was that the way we consume news media is not as, you know, it's far more voracious, yeah, and far, yeah, more saturated than it was back then. You know, back then you'd have had Liverpool on telly every now and again, a bit of a radio debate and in the papers. Now you've got those things times 10, well, TV well. Opportunities endless, and, you know, fan sites, YouTube, social media, everything. And yet we're at this point now where it's still reflective of that era, because it helps fans who don't like Manchester United laugh at them, because you go, ha, you're no longer Fergie's Man United. And then it also handicaps fans who, like, are super fans who want to go back to the glory days.
No, there's just a business case for covering Manchester United. I mean, it's as simple as that. They are that popular a football team. But the reality is, in the context of what we're talking about, they aren't going to figure, which is the Premier League. They're just not going to figure. They are a spare part. You know, it doesn't matter the magnitude or popularity of the club in terms of the competition, the table, the 20 teams, the points, the wins, the draws, the losses.
Let's ban them from talking about them on the podcast then, between now and the end of the season.
No, listen, but when we talk about them, we're talking about a team who is mid-table to Europa League standard.
Yeah.
They're an interesting story because of their history, but in terms of their current football team, they aren't, you know. And it might be there are some good subplots in there, because you've got Harry Maguire, you know, England players, and players who cost a lot of money and some superstars and stuff like that. But again, in terms of the competition itself, there are many teams with lesser known players who are better sides, and you have to cover them because of the business case. People see Manchester United on the back of newspapers, hear about them on the radio, and they want to listen because that's the team that they support. Many people support Manchester United. But again, in terms of the competition, the reason that I call this the end point for Manchester United is the second placed finish was the point that people went, ah, see? We are that sleeping giant. We can get back to winning the title. Here comes Rafa Varane and Cristiano Ronaldo and Jadon Sancho. They're going to take us to greatness. No, the club is not set up to do it. It's not run to do it. Nothing about them now is the Manchester United of old. They're not at the cutting edge. You can bring in great players if you want. They're not going to factor, because all of the other factors are not good enough. And that's it. I think people need to realise it. You know, this season should have shown them. They're not good enough. And Erik ten Hag's done an interview with Manchester United where he's told the club that it will take five years for them to challenge. Five. So 2027, see you soon.
I think he's being optimistic as well.
Okay, thanks. Are you trying to just get at me there?
Because
it doesn't get to me.
I genuinely think he is being optimistic as well. The key difference in the game was the effort levels and the desire, of which Everton had far more, and Match of the Day picked it out, didn't they?
But again, I don't take any of these current performances and this current squad to be what's about to happen next for Manchester United. I tweeted not like after the Leicester game, now's the time to give the under-23s experience. These guys don't care. Loads of them are leaving. They're not. You saw again against Everton. They're not interested. I don't understand why a lot of them are out on the pitch. Like, let them go and choose their new clubs, put them on the bench, bring them on if you need them for the last 5 minutes. Anyone who is going to be at the club in the future, give them the opportunity to learn something. Give them the opportunity to show that they might be a great player for the club in the future. Like, do something with the organisation that is going to be conducive to a positive future, as opposed to, I mean, why would Paul Pogba start games now? I don't get it. Like, alright, Juan Mata came on at the weekend and everyone was like, why is Juan Mata coming on? It's like, well, I think he probably wants to be at Man United. I mean, he's not got it anymore, but I think he likes being there. I think he wants the club to do well, so he came on.
Juan Mata's downfall after going to Manchester United is one of the saddest things about it all, isn't he? Such a lovely lad. Yeah. He deserves far better.
Yeah, I'll stop ranting about Man United. Just finally, are Everton safe? 4 points ahead of Burnley, same games played. Obviously, Burnley we're going to talk about next, so we might as well roll this all into one. Beaten at Norwich. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. 2-0. After their win against Everton especially, I thought they're going to back this up. Norwich are the worst team in the league. Away from home, yes, but they have to win it. So I'm asking you, really, a Burnley now down / are Everton now safe?
Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes, Everton is safe. Yeah, that was one of those where I answered it in my head before I even said it out loud. Yes, Everton are safe, and yes, Burnley are down. I say that with a slight hint of anger, because my Burnley boys, part-time fan that I am, like with Arsenal and lots of other teams, it seems, they were really frustrating and really poor. They just didn't do the, yeah, it's a cliche, didn't do the simple things well. And but also, credit to Norwich, they were the far better team who actually looked like they had a plan, looked far better going forward, more cohesive in attack. And Burnley never really looked like scoring either. There wasn't that kind of barrage of overlapping fullbacks and balls into the box. It was really poor. And I think, yeah, I've said it before, being a bit un-Burnley like this season, that again was another time when I was like, who is this? This isn't Burnley. What's going on? And so that's what will cost them. And again, Everton, it's a classic Everton under Frank Lampard as well. Their two kind of best performances, I think, at home to Manchester City, where they should have got a draw, and now at home to Manchester United, pressure off. They'll pick up the points just about enough. I wouldn't be surprised if they then went and lost the next two, but they'll be just about okay, I think.
I disagree, actually. I think this is the only game that you'd say Burnley were not the underdog and they didn't cope with that very well. And they did not expect Norwich to play with such freedom and good organisation. So that was a double whammy for them there. From now on, Dyche will get them up for the games that they face. And I just feel if it's a straight fight between Dyche and Lampard, I'd put my money.
What are you talking about? In a boxing ring or in a football
boxing
context?
Ring, in the velodrome. I do feel it was a very peculiar day for results. I agree, but let's not forget Burnley did beat Everton, so that has to count for something. And I don't. Burnley are very good at having a terrible time or a terrible performance or it going wrong and bouncing back. And so they will. History has showed us that they will. And they're not going to be, you know, the favourites again. Everyone before the game against Norwich was saying, there's absolutely no way Burnley won't win this. Sometimes don't react well to that at all. So they'll clear that out of their heads. They'll realise what went wrong. Corne missed a sitter. Who knows if that had gone in. They'll be fine. I think they'll get more points. And I think Everton's run-in doesn't change just because they beat Manchester United. The games they have coming up remain difficult games. And you can't sit here and say how appalling an end of an era it has been for Manchester United and how appalling they were in that game and then claim that that means a lot for Everton. Everton were lucky to be playing a dreadful Manchester United. And they didn't...
No, but
you know, it was backs to the wall, even though Man United weren't very good. What does that say about you?
No, yeah, I know what you're saying, but I think every single game you win down at the bottom of the table is always a surprise, and the opposition can't be playing at their best if they're above you in the table and you beat them pretty much. So I know what you're saying there, but I think the reason that Burnley didn't beat Norwich was the fact that Everton beat Manchester United. I actually thought they didn't cope well with the right. You have to win. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I also think we should, again, the classic case of opposition fans pulling their hair out while they listen to us. Norwich were excellent. That's the best I've seen Norwich for a while, yeah, actually. I think they were really good. Not just in a kind of gritty, determined, playing at home, getting 3 points. I think they played some really nice stuff.
Yeah.
Which you can do if you're at the point of no return. Often a team rediscovers something.
But I just wonder whether those teams at the bottom will all do that, and actually that in the next few weeks they'll kind of relegate themselves in a strange way, if that makes any sense. You know, and I speak as a selfish editor who wants interesting storylines all the way to the end of the season, but I was partly sat there as well going, for God's sake, Norwich, I'd kind of written you off already. I really wanted Burnley v Everton all the way to the end of the season. You've gone and spoiled it, for God's sake.
Yeah, we'll see with that relegation battle. I think that's got many more twists and turns, thankfully, because they're all so bad. Listen, before we go, there is one club's set of fans out there who are screaming, saying, well, what about us? You've slammed us recently. You've criticised us. You have torn us to shreds. And we haven't even got a mention.
That could be literally anyone.
on the game podcast. So I will mention you, Chelsea. Yes, Chelsea, who, of course, went to Southampton and won 6-0. Mainly, I mention you because of the great article, once again, by Bill Edgar, the game in numbers, 10-goal turnaround. Chelsea produced only the second case in top-flight history of a team conceding at least 4 goals at home and then scoring at least 6 away in consecutive games. Of course, they lost 4-1 at Brentford, 6-0 at Southampton, and emulate Manchester United 2 matches either side of Christmas in 1977. Yes, many of you remember it well, I'm sure. 4-0 down against Nottingham Forest at Old Trafford, and then beating Everton 6-2 at Goodison Park. I'm not going to spoil the rest of the article. Make sure you check it out. Bill Edgar's game in numbers. And Chelsea fans, we, of course, will talk about you in more detail after that second leg against Real Madrid. So stay tuned. I'm sure there'll be a lot of Chelsea chat on Thursday. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Tom Clark, Alison Rudd, and Paul Hurst, who was with us a little bit earlier on. Remember, make sure you're subscribed to The Times and The Sunday Times. If you sign up today, you'll get yourself a month free. As always, check it out at thetimes.co.uk/thegame. And make sure you're subscribed to the podcast too. So hit that like, hit that star, whatever you need to do. And we will see you on Thursday. Take care.